Action.
1, 2. Only 2 people know. And 2 marvelous Horatio knows.
Can they recite it for us?
No, I'm not going to do all the work. Well, I propose that that, together with the poem by Yeats that we're going to look at today, Easter 1916, are the 2 greatest political poems in the language. They have, as considered as political poems, a great deal in common. And I would like, over the weekend, you to study Easter 1916 on the basis of what I shall say about it today, and compare it with this poem. And on Monday be prepared to talk about the 2 poems together, or talk about the Yeats poem by comparison with the Marvell poem. Quite extraordinary, I find, that in a class of graduates and undergraduate seniors, I get a score like that for one of the great poems of the English language. Easter 1916 is on pages 85 through 87. We're now considering these 2 collections, The Wild Swans of Cool and Michael Robartes and the Dancer, together. Although the dates you are given for the one is 1919 and for the other 1921, and these are correct, in fact, as I hope is clear by now, these are 2 collections made by Yeats out of a body of poetry which he had been writing contemporaneously. So although the 2 collections came out with 2 years between them, this does not mean to say, obviously when you think about it, that the poems in the later collection were written in the 2 years after the appearance of the earlier one. By no means. These are the poems that Yeats was writing through the years of the First World War and the Civil War which followed it. Well, the war between England and Ireland, which followed it in Ireland. It's a particularly clear example, in fact, of the way in which by this time Yeats is distinctly not just collecting all the poems that he happens to have written in the last few years and pushed them into a book. He let these poems accumulate and then sorted them into 2 collections. It's only when you see the collections as a whole, or as when you see them in the collected, that you can work out the basis on which he did make these distinctions. It is somewhat obscured for you, since you are following only a selection from both collections. There are several principles operating. One of them we have seen already. It is the Wild Swans of Cool volume, into which he packs those poems which are a sort of, as he said, ominously, scriptural texts, written straight out of the system and for exegesis. These are kept out of Michael Robartes and the Dancer. So that's one of the differences. Another is, and I hope you may have realized this too, we're concerned here with 2 wars going on at the same time, and Yeats, in some sense, concerned with both of them as an Anglo-Irishman. First, the First World War, the so-called Great War of 1914 to 1919, and this is the war which is spoken of, by and large, in the Wild Swans at Cool. This is the war of the Irish airman foresees his death. This is the war in which that Irish airman, Robert Gregory, goes to his death, and which is therefore in the background of that poem, that long poem in memory of Major Robert Gregory, which I shall want us to go back to and look at before we move on from these 2 collections considered together. Whereas the war of the 2nd collection, Michael Robartes and the Dancer, is the war between the English and the Irish, as it flared up in 1916 and thereafter. A very interesting distinction between these 2 collections, and you will find me arguing this in that essay on Michael Robartes and the Dancer, in the volume An Honoured Guest, which I sent it to him, is that when you have microbodies in the delta as a whole, you will see that nearly all of that volume is in fact concerned with the position of woman. A very, very large proportion of the poems are looked at from the point of view of a woman, or looked at from the point of view of a man speaking of the women that he loves and asking himself and them what are the appropriate functions for a woman to perform. This meaning not just the women that he was in love with, but his daughter is born, Anne Yates, and this lovely poem at the end of My Robust and the Dancer, A Prayer for My Daughter. There are the women whom he is not sexually tied to at all, like the Golbooth sisters, Countess Malkovich. I have said in the past, rather flippantly, more than once, that Yeats was a sexist or a male chauvinist pig. These, of course, are vulgar expressions which have no very limited meaning. In fact, Yeats thought very seriously about the position of woman in the society which he knew and the better society which he thought had once existed and which he hoped might come again. The conclusions that he reaches about the role of woman are distinctly unpalatable, I suppose, for most militant feminists today wouldn't recommend themselves to the women's liberation movement. But they are, in fact, arguable, and in their way, they, as in his way, which is a very unfashionable way, they establish for woman a very crucial and irreplaceable role indeed in what Yeats is most concerned with: the cultural heritage, the maintenance of it, the preservation of it, the passing of it on from one generation to the next. Well, we look at those poems, or some of those poems, later, or rather, I would suggest, those of you who are interested in this, they needn't be only the women among you, might care to read Michael Robartes and the Dancer as a whole. It's a slim collection in any case, perhaps with the aid of my commentary, and perhaps sometime next week, offer your own observations or quarrels with it, observations on this matter, or questions about it. In Easter 1916, however, which is the poem that we're now going to be concerned with, this is only tangentially present, but it is present, at the beginning of the second section. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill. This is, as I have had occasion to explain before, the woman among the leaders of the abortive and indeed doomed rising. Countess Markievicz. And what is said about her takes its place in what he goes on to say about the other male leaders, McDonough, McBride, Connolly, and Pierce. Also, as I pointed out yesterday, the next poem in your selection, which follows this, On the Political Prisoner, is also about Con Markievicz. It says, addressing itself as we have seen poems do already, particularly in relation to Maud Gonne, or what they will continue to do, it's a thing that he never disbelieves. What is the role of woman in politics? Has she won? Does a woman deny her own nature? And does she, from whatever noble motives, in fact, evade and escape what is her principal cultural and social duty by making herself an active politician? I'll read Easter 1916. I had met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among grey 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head or polite, meaningless words. Or had lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words. And thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire of the club. Being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn. All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers when, young and beautiful, she wrote to Harriet? This man had kept to school and rode our winged horse. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. This other man I had dreamed a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who were near my heart. Yet I number him in the song. He too had resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too had been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter seem enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. A shadow of cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim and a horse clashes within it. The long-legged moorhens dive and hens to moorcocks call. Minute by minute they live, the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? That is heaven's part, our part, to murmur name upon name as a mother names her child when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? No, no, not night, but death. Was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. We know their dream enough to know they dreamed and are dead. What if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse. McDonough and McBride and Connolly and Pierce, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed. Changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Specifically dated in the first publicly printed edition, September 25th, 1916. Something like 5 months after the rising of Easter that year, when the rising had been suppressed, when the leaders, the 16 dead men, had been summarily executed by the British, and the women among them were in jail. Consider we should be prepared for this now. We know all the facts, enough that we need to know about what the rising of Easter 1916 was, what function it was meant to perform. For instance, from what I was saying yesterday, you will recall that, in fact, Home Rule was virtually assured, by at the end of the war. The new factor which came into it, which destroyed both the English liberal program for Ireland and the Irish Republican program, was the sudden, relatively sudden, a very formidable military preparedness of Ulster. And it was in the light of that, of Sir Edward Carson's declared intention to fight rather than be included in a republic of the whole island. It's in the light of that consideration, among others, that these men launched this rising in Dublin, which had, let this be plain, let me say it again, had never any hope of short-term success. They knew this when they undertook it. They were there to create heroes, create martyrs, because in the long, they were interested only in the long-term effects. They knew perfectly well that in the middle of the European War, the British could not afford to negotiate, could not do any other than bring a major force over the Irish Sea and suppress the rising fiercely. For instance, the men of 1916 had no contacts, worth talking about anyway, with Germany. There was no question of their rising being synchronized with a landing of a German naval force. Though that, you remember, is the only possible way in which a military rising ever could have success, as it had done through the years, when England's enemy had been France, then it had been French ships and French armies that had been looked to. Before that, way back in the time of the First Elizabeth, it had been Spanish ships and Spanish armies. Now, it was to be, if it was to be any help at all, it would have to be help from Germany. But this was never prepared for. Thus, it was a forlorn hope from the first. It came into being as an alliance between those disparate forces which I had written up on the board yesterday, or some of them, between the Irish Republican Brotherhood, Sinn Féin, and the infant Irish Socialist Movement. These four names, MacDonagh, MacBride, Connolly, Pearce. Connolly, James Connolly, is the socialist leader. Pearce and MacDonagh were members of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and MacBride, I believe, was represented Sinn Féin. This did not come entirely as a surprise to the British authorities. In the months before the rising, the Citizen Army, as it called itself, had drilled and marched in and around Dublin, and had been tolerated, had indeed been mocked and derided by the Irish as well as the English, as just a fancy dress private army marching and parading. Only that was all they did. They thought they were no serious threat, and so they were tolerated contemptuously. And this is at least part of what Yeats is talking about in the first section. Thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jive to please a companion around the fire of the club. You will recall too that Yeats had cooled off drastically many years before on the active part that he had taken in the movement for Irish independence. But years before this, he had come to think that if an independent Ireland came, it would be a mass democracy of small shopkeepers, precisely the last sort of society that he wanted. Hence, the rising took him entirely by surprise, apparently, because he'd been out of touch with the active revolutionary movement. And it, of course, provoked him into thinking about his own history and of his own involvement. It is often said that this poem shows Yeats shocked back into a feeling of remorse and guilt at having cooled off and deserted the nationalist cause. This, I think, however, careful reading of the poem, or a reasonable reading, reasonably careful reading of the poem, does not bear this out. In fact, this is one of the most striking things about it. One would suppose him to have said, "My God, they've done it at last. They really have proved that they meant it. They really have made a heroic and tragic gesture, precisely those things which I claim, which I thought they never were going to be able to do. How wrong I was, how ashamed I feel of not having been there with them." This is not what the poem says, in fact. Another aspect of the matter which is very often overlooked, but which I hope you will see for yourself and which you have been prepared for, has to do precisely with this refrain, "A terrible beauty is born." Famous line, famous refrain, people find it moving, but they just say terrible, meaning, you know, oh, horrible, oh, awful, quite vague, emotive word. He means it absolutely, specifically, a terrible beauty. He means terror. And the proof of that is in the way in which, insistently, he introduces comedy against tragedy. Thus, at the end of the first section, thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire of the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is wore. Motley, the traditional emblematic dress of the jester, is a cap and belt, is a mottled patchwork. I was sure, I was certain that they and I, he and his friends that he meets at the club, his acquaintances, live where motley is bought. And then suddenly all changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. In other words, the beauty of tragedy. A tragic beauty. Terrible, meaning going back undoubtedly to Aristotle's Poetics, where tragedy is defined as that form of art which arouses and then perhaps assuages pity and terror. The same thing is picked up again in the second, at the end of the second stanza, if it's quite a stanza, trophy would be a better word, top of page 86, where he's talking about McBride. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. And we have seen this before. I've said it so many times we're getting tired of hearing it said. The particular sort of Irishman that Yeats represents, the Anglo-Irishman who comes, as we know, in various shapes and sizes, it is a matter of historical record that the literary form in which the Anglo-Irish have most excelled has, in fact, been comedy, theatrical comedy. The great masters of theatrical comedy since Shakespeare and Ben Jonson, in English, are nearly all of them Anglo-Irishmen, of one sort or another. I have given you the names before. Goldsmith and Sheridan, and Oscar Wilde and George Bernard Shaw, and through to, in our time, Shauna Casey and Samuel Beckett. To whom we can add others. Thus, we find it difficult to think about, in fact, Swift's Gulliver's Travels and his Tale of a Tub, which we think of as savage and rather appalling satire, were esteemed by Swift's own closest friends in London, by Pope and Arbuthnot, as comedy, Rabelaisian comedy. There is a peculiar, it's a very bleak and acrid sort of comedy, which, as you know, think for a moment of Samuel Beckett, Waiting for Godot, and the other plays, are comedies, though comedies of a peculiarly black and acrid kind. What's more, you will remember that Yeats was disconcerted. He was, you could see this happening most notably in autobiographies. As a young man, he wanted to, he found it difficult to find room for comedy as a great form of literary art. He wanted tragedy, he wanted the heroic, particularly in Ireland. He wanted Ireland to become heroic and tragic, to produce tragic and heroic art to equal in sheer intrinsic value the comic art, the great comic art which Ireland had produced. And he, remember, took Thomas Davis and others who had attempted the heroic and tragic and said, although I esteem their intentions, that it's just not well enough written. And this is what he was asking for. This was what he thought he was going to get when he found John Millington Synge. And in due course, in fact, John Millington Synge did write tragedies. But the great work, the work which made his name was perhaps the most exuberant, though also one of the most blackest, one of the blackest of all the Irish comedies, a playboy of the Western world. And Yeats was disconcerted by this. It was not what he expected things to have done. You can see him in some later pages of autobiographies on the death of Singh and the section called Estrangement. You can see him arguing himself into a position in which he can esteem what Singh has done. He knows it's a great play. He knows it's a great work of literature. He is disconcerted because it turns out to be once again comedy rather than tragedy. All of this is involved when the rising takes place. Because this is a tragic, a heroic gesture by the Irish. And when Yeats says a terrible beauty is born, he is saying, in effect, they've done it, they've proved what one has waited for all this time. Yes, they have proved that Irishmen can rise to a tragic art and life. Whereas I thought, as we all thought, as we had good reason for thinking, that we were never going to be anything but comedians. You may remember that in a poem about Parnell, even Parnell is called the great comedian. Now, you may say, well, but come, I mean, we're talking about art on the one hand, things that happen on a theatre, and here we're talking about life, I mean, real people who were really shocked. But for Yeats, as I hope, I don't think you have realised by now, I think you can't read autobiographies without realising it. For Yeats, the world of art and of life were not distinct as they are for, perhaps for most of us, and certainly for the Philistine. Indeed, he does talk about here, as he does when he talks about Parnell, in terms of, these are phrases which you use, the stage, the arena of political action. We say things like, it was in 1809 that Daniel O'Connell first appeared upon the political scene, first made his entry upon the political stage. In other words, we do fairly consistently, in fact, though without thinking about it, see the arena of politics in theatrical terms. Yeats takes this very, very seriously indeed. You'll remember that when he's talking about Parnell, he is ultimately admires Parnell so much, not because Parnell was a highly effective politician, though he was, but because of the style with which he led his political party. You will remember that when the scandal broke, as it were, all that was required of Parnell was to step down from the leadership of the Irish members and admit that he had unfitted himself for leading them anymore since his name had been dragged through the divorce courts. And the political historian, and indeed the politician of the time, reproaches Parnell for not having done that. That was what practical politics required. Our practical politics required him to swallow his pride. Parnell, you remember, refused to do that, made it an absolute issue of loyalty. I make no excuse. I deny nothing. Am I the leader of my own party or am I not? And therefore broke his party and destroyed the political effectiveness of the Irish members for a decade. Yeats admires him for this. In fact, in life, both private life and public life, just as in art, what Yeats is looking for is style. A lifestyle, we use that phrase too, and we use it rather loosely. Yeats didn't use that particular phrase, but it was very, very crucial to him. You lived with style. You could live with a tragic or heroic style just as you could write with tragic or heroic style. In other words, Yeats's view was consistently aesthetic all the way through. He saw the life of politics as art being acted out in real life. And when you come to this, in fact, it is really rather shocking. Hardly ever is Yeats making a moral distinction, a moral judgment. It is not a matter of was Parnell a good man or a bad man, was Parnell an effective politician or an ineffective one. It is, was the spectacle of Parnell as he acted in public an aesthetically satisfying spectacle? And this, you might think, then means that he's thereby cut off and debarred from understanding and sympathizing with political action, since this is not the way that most people regard politics. But the point about the rising of 1916 was that this too was wholly a theatrical, symbolic action. The rising of 1916 was not practical politics. Hence, Yeats responds to it in precisely these terms. Here are men and women who acted as if the political arena was a stage on which you were to play out your part with heroic consistency to the tragic denouement which you have seen before you start. And this is what moves him, and this is what he means by a terrible beauty. He's not approving them as politicians. He's not approving them as moral beings. He is approving them as having created a magnificent aesthetic spectacle. Up to this point, the poem is relatively straightforward. The whole of the second section, incidentally, I suppose, should be glossed. I have said, that woman's days, and the lines which follow, when young and beautiful she rode to Harry as we know her by now, Constance Gorbooth, Con Markiewicz, from Miss Adele, whom Yeats had known as the daughters of the big house when he was a child in Sligo. This man had kept a school and rode our winged horse, is Patrick Pearse, P-A-R-S-E. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive and his nature seemed so daring and sweet his thought. But indeed Pearse's friend, Thomas McDonough. Interesting thing here, both Pearse and McDonough were poets, and McDonough was in fact lecturer in English in National University that had been created for the Roman Catholic population of Ireland, called the Royal University at first. It had been founded about 1860, in the 1860s. Cardinal John Henry Newman, his famous book, a classic, The Idea of a University, was in fact written as a draft prospectus for the Royal and Catholic University that was to be founded in Dublin. This is the university at which, in the 1870s, the English Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins was a lecturer in classics. This is the university to which James Joyce went, and where a great deal of the earlier chapters of The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man are set in this university. McDonough was a lecturer in English in this university, and in fact, he had time before he died to write one book of scholarship, which you can find. It is a small, but for its time, a valuable and pioneering book about the early 17th century lyrical poet Thomas Campion. I've not had occasion to check whether it's in our library. It ought to be. This is, perhaps brings it near to us. These are not romantic characters like the wild geese emerging from mysterious baronial estates on the Atlantic shore. These are people pursuing their career just like us, in precisely our sort of milieu, with the difference that they happen to be Irish. And that's what makes all the difference. This other one I had dreamed a drunken, vainglorious lout, he had done most bitter wrong to some who were near my heart, is John McBride, who in fact had married Maud Gonne, treated her badly. By him she bore Sean McBride, who is still alive, who was Foreign Minister of the Republic immediately after the Second World War in the late 1940s, and who indeed, I believe, was accorded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in Southwest Africa. So there you have it. Countess Markovitz, Portrick Pierce, McDonough, Sean McBride. And they're all quoted at the end with the addition of James Connolly. Now the third section, the thing gets much more complicated. Hearts with one purpose alone. You will notice that I made a shot at reading this with a rather heavier than usual Anglo-Irish accent, which of course is a fake as far as I'm concerned. But it's important to do when Yeats is writing as tightly as this, in these short lines, every syllable counts, and certain syllables have a totally different phonetic quality in an Irish mouth from what they have in an English mouth or an American one. For instance, hearts with one purpose alone. The R, the medial R, is in fact there in Irish pronunciation. Hearts with one purpose alone. That gives a quite different and greater weight to the syllables in which they occur. Through summer and winter seem enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. A horse that comes from the road, a rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, and here those, cloud to tumbling cloud, and that much more rounded vowel than the normal British or normal American pronunciation would give. All of this has the effect of slowing down and giving considerable weight to what otherwise we would be inclined to read altogether too fast, altogether too trippingly for what these lines are saying. More strikingly, in the next line, minute by minute they change. And that is the Anglo-Irish pronunciation, where the English pronunciation is the tripping little minute by minute. Minute by minute. I mean, it's quite different, isn't it? Minute by minute. Hey. Oh, minute by minute they live. He picks it up at the end. The stones in the midst of all. Now, with this image of the stone in the stream, the whole moral and aesthetic picture becomes enormously complicated. Hearts with one purpose alone. That's what these people have. These were the hearts that they had. These are the hearts that you need to have for true, fanatically consistent extremist political action. They were fanatics. They were therefore stony hearted. Their hearts were turned to stone. This is what it means. The true radical has to be ruthless with himself, with others. He cannot afford affections. Whether he's a radical of the right or a radical of the left like a Bolshevik. And so the living stream is the stream that goes on around them. And all the images of life, mutability, protean change, shifting colour, define the things which these people are not and cannot afford to be. It is the stream that is living. It is they, therefore, they are a peculiar sort of dead fixity in that stream. The things which the stream brings with it, the horse, the rider on the horse, the ranging birds, the shifting clouds that tumble against each other, the shifting cloud shadow on the water changes minute by minute. It is of the nature of life to do this, to change minute by minute, to be continually protean and changing. This is what life means. The horse hoof slides, the horse clashes with it. And it is, among other things, hens to moorcocks. This too is the whole, all the activities of sexual pairing, of sexual ecstasy, of the generation of offspring. All of these belong in the world of change, continual change, minute by minute. The people whom we are honouring and celebrating have denied that in themselves necessarily. This is what it means. Thus, at this point, we are indeed admiring them for the heroic consistency. We are counting, however, the cost to them and to their family, their relatives, and their loved ones. And thus the whole thing becomes much more complicated. We are admiring it, the fixity and consistency of the fanatical purpose which drives to its tragic end. At the same time as we are saying, it is stony, it is dead. So then he attempts to draw a conclusion, to draw a model, and the really touching thing is that he attempts it and realizes that he cannot do it. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Well, we've just seen how. Indeed, we've seen it many times before. The sacrifice of Maud Gonne to Irish nationalist politics. We have seen Yeats, some years before this, in poem after poem, trying to make sense of this spectacle of the woman that he loved, who had necessarily keeled out of herself, frozen out of herself, whatever would have made it possible for her to respond to his love. Yes?
Did she do anything during the rising?
No, she was out of touch. She was, in fact, in France. I think by this time, she's never got actively engaged. I have to check on this. I think that by this time, she had been superseded in the councils of the Irish revolutionary movement. She was still active and still a nuisance to herself and her friends and to the English authorities. There's an amusing couple of letters from Pound to John Quinn when she was passed. She was not supposed to move in England at all. She was not supposed to be in England, but she did visit England. And there was a drastic appeal to, you know, the inevitable fixer of everything, Ezra Pound, to meet her and smuggle her onto the Irish boat train. And he's got this exasperated letter about it. She spent her time mostly in France, and it was in France that Yeats wrote to her about this. Yeats is writing, there are letters from Yeats to her after the Easter Rising, in which he is, in fact, working out, you can see in letters, the first half of what we have seen him say in this poem. That's to say, it is plain that Maud Gonne's attitude to it was the attitude which Yeats has expressed through the first two strophes of this poem. It is now, when we get to this business about the heart with one purpose alone, that Yeats moves beyond what Maud Gonne could have agreed with, and for obvious reasons, because Yeats has Maud Gonne in mind as well as the others. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Well, how long is too long? Which is the question. Or when may it suffice? How long is too long? Did you say thus far and no further? Do you say I have given 10 years to the cause and now I have a right to a private life? These are impossible questions, really. So he says, and he says so, that is heaven's far. By which, of course, he doesn't mean the Christian heaven particularly. He means fate works out. We can't answer that. Humanity can't. And in fact, all we can do, our part, to murmur name upon name as a mother names her child. That is all we can do. We, the survivors, and we, the poets, all we can do when something like this has happened is not say, yes, they were right, or no, they were wrong, or it is merely to commemorate, to remember. That is all we can do, is keep their name green, and hence, at the end, the name. I write it out in the verse, and he names them. McDonough and McBride and Connolly and Pearson. That's all you can do. I think it is an example of how deeply he was moved and engaged, in that this is one of the very few places in Yeats where he does what is a psychologically difficult thing for any man to do, and particularly for a man who was so jealous of his own virility as Yeats was. You will have seen that Yeats in general is, with almost tedious consistency in fact, presenting himself in his capacity as poet in virile, arrogant, masculine terms. Here he gets to the point of in fact identifying himself with the female and the maternal role, saying that the poet is like, in such a situation as this at any rate, the poet is like the mother whose children have run in from, tired from a day's play, and who drowse asleep, and she does no more than croon to them the names of them, while presumably caressing them as they fall asleep, which is a very peculiarly, very unusually, soft and maternal, and very, very feminine image for Yeats to use, and one that he very seldom does. Was it needless death after all, for England may keep faith for all that is done and said? And again, that is another question, a question of was it politically said, did it make political sense to do this? And again, this is a question which he raises and leaves.